I mean, you've got to be joking, haven't you? What sort of a chapter is this to ask anybody to preach on? Especially one that ends, as Sue, who read it to me, pointed out in the vestry just before we go in, that she was reading a chapter which would end, that the vision was beyond understanding. And then Chris Wright would come and help us all to understand it. But here we've got it, isn't it? A two-horned ram charging about the place, a unicorn he-goat charging in. I mean, this is the stuff of fantasy and movies, isn't it? How can we take a text like this seriously? Well, perhaps not so fast, because actually we ourselves in our ordinary everyday culture are very familiar with personifying animals one way or another. We make them into caricatures of humans, or we use them as a way of describing humans. We say to somebody, "You cheeky monkey." Or we talk about fat cats and the government being a lame duck or something like that. We use animals in that way. And also, of course, we have very famous animal characters that have become virtually human, like Mickey Mouse or the Lion King or Jungle Book, right up to the kind of digitized virtual world of a computerized fantasy where human beings and animals and mythical creatures all blend together in a whole new world, as in the movie Avatar. And in fact, in some of the visions of Daniel, such as in chapter 2 and chapter 7 and here again in chapter 8, it really is rather like that. It's a kind of 3D virtual reality in which Daniel is portraying and interpreting the real world of the present and the future, but he's doing it through the medium of a kind of audio, visual, virtual screenplay of the imagination. So it's not entirely removed from our everyday use to use animals in that way with a symbolic kind of meaning. And of course also we're quite familiar with what you might call animalizing nations. That's to say, using particular animals as a way of embodying a whole nation or some particular characteristic of it. There's the famous British Bulldogs, or when we go out and play rugby overseas, we like to call ourselves the British Lions, for obvious reasons. And when we play South Africa, we're playing against the Springboks. I dare say there's probably a few Kiwis here this evening from New Zealand. And, well, perhaps I better not mention frogs. So what we have here in Daniel is something that we do. We're familiar with it. The use of animals in order to represent something symbolic and in order to speak of actual people and real nations, real empires in real history. And then to use that imagery to make some very important points and to ask some very challenging questions. The imagery is drawn from the realm of fantasy and vision, but what it's talking about is real enough. And so we still need to ask what is going on here and what has it got to say to us. But let's first of all look at what Daniel actually saw and when and where. Look closely at verses 1 and 2 of the chapter. He tells us that it was the third year of King Belshazzar. Now that was the king who last appeared in chapter 5. He was the king when you read about the writing on the wall. It's in his reign. He was one of the last kings of Babylon. And so we know, therefore, that Daniel is still in the Babylonian Empire, but it's very close to the end of that particular king. And Daniel tells us that this vision he has now in chapter 8 was after the one that had already appeared to me, which, of course, refers back to chapter 7, which we were looking at last week with Roger Salisbury. And in chapter 7, you have this even weirder dream, really, of some terrifying sequence of four beasts that arise from the sea. And they symbolize four empires to come. Rather like chapter 2, where Daniel, there'd been a dream of a statue composed of four different metals, gold and silver and bronze and iron. And in each case, chapter 2, the statue, and chapter 7, the four animals, what we have is a pattern of empires. That indeed is my first point. This is a pattern of empires which arise one after the other but are ultimately destroyed by God's power, which in chapter 2 takes the form of a rock that shatters the statue, and chapter 7 is the Son of Man who comes with supreme power and authority. And the pattern then is a kind of foreshadowing in the history that was to follow Daniel of the centuries up to the coming of the Lord Jesus Christ and in a sense the inauguration of the reign of God, the kingdom of God through Christ. but it points to an underlying pattern in history. Empires rise and fall. They rise and they overreach themselves in blasphemous arrogance until ultimately they are finally overthrown by God. That's the pattern that you have, especially in chapter 2 and chapter 7. And here now, in chapter 8, Daniel picks out of that sequence of four the two next ones that were to come after the empire of Babylon that he was in. And so he tells us, you see again there in verse 2, that in my vision I saw myself in the citadel of Susa in the province of Elam. Now Susa was to become one of the capital cities of the Persian Empire. And so the next picture is of the Persian Empire and then the Greek Empire. We can see that as we move through and you read the interpretation. So let's quickly do that and go back over the story, just in case it's not quite so familiar to you as John 3:16 and other passages of the Bible that you perhaps read a little bit more often. First of all, there's the vision of the two-horned ram. You see him there in verses 3 and 4, and then again in the interpretation in verse 20, where we're told that this stands for the empire of the Medes and the Persians, who were unified by the Emperor Cyrus in 540 BC, who then conquered the empire of Babylon, and then very rapidly spread all over the area of the world that we would now call the Middle East, or the Near East and Middle East. The whole Eastern Mediterranean from Turkey and Egypt and Palestine and Lebanon, right over towards Syria and Jordan and then Iraq and Iran and right across to the very edges of India. That became the Persian Empire and it ruled for 200 years, beginning with King Cyrus. But then secondly, there comes this kind of unicorn he-goat. A goat with one horn through between its eyes, which is a kind of fantastic creature. And you read of him there in verse 5 to 7, when you see him. And then again in the interpretation in verse 21. And in the interpretation, we are told that this represents the Greek conquest of Persia that took place under Alexander the Great, who became king of Macedon, after a period, in fact, in which Persia had been trying to conquer Greece. Some of you may have heard of the Battle of Marathon and Thermopylae and the Spartans and all the great victories that the Greeks won defending themselves against the Persians. Well, when that was over, the Greeks themselves were unified under Philip and then under his son Alexander. And then in 333, Alexander crossed the Bosphorus, went into Turkey and just swept through the Persian Empire like a knife through butter and conquered it in a very swift period of battles. And so he then rules the world, or that part of the world, from Greece in the west, right over to the very boundaries of India in the east. That's as far as he got. But, as we're told here, the horn was cut off because Alexander died young, died at the age of 32 in 323 BC, verse 8 and verse 22. And before he died, Alexander divided up his empire that he had conquered all the way from Greece to India. And he divided it up between four generals. That's what you could do in those days. You just carved the world up. Well, not entirely only in those days, but that's what he did. Just carved the world up and gave it to his four generals. And so the world, or that world, from Greece to India, effectively became Greek for more than 200 years, until eventually Greece itself was conquered by Rome, and the world became Roman, and that would then lead you through to the New Testament. And then finally, in the vision from verse 8 to 12, and 23 to 25, Daniel says that out of those four horns, which represents the four Greek kingdoms of the Greek Empire, there was one who arose, a ruler who would come and rule a particular part of the world. And his name, we now know from history, was Antiochus the Fourth, who called himself Epiphanes, which means the appearance of a god. He set himself up as the avatar of Zeus, the god of the Greeks, the supreme god of the Greeks. He was in fact the ruler of one of the four parts of the Greek Empire, the part that was in Syria, with its capital in Antioch. That's why he called himself Antiochus. And he became king 175 years before Christ. And he acted with great hostility and hatred and arrogance towards the Israelites who were still living in the land of Palestine, there in the city of Jerusalem. And he became the great enemy of God's people at that time, the very embodiment of evil and oppression and suffering under Antiochus Epiphanes. Well, that's the pattern of empires that the dream shows. And you see that it reaches its climax with, and this is the second thing we look at, with a portrait of evil. The wickedness of Antiochus is summarized for us there in verses 10 to 12 and 23 to 25. Perhaps it's worth just looking at them because it really describes what he's doing. In verse 10, of course, it refers to the little horn. That's what he was, kind of big chief little horn. It grew until it reached the host of heavens, right up to the heavens, and even tried to throw down some of the starry host. Set itself up to be as great as the prince of the host, that is God himself. Took away the daily sacrifice from the place of the sanctuary was brought low. And because of rebellion of the host of the saints, the daily sacrifice was given over to it. It prospered at everything it did, and truth was thrown to the ground. And then in verse 23 and 24, verse 24, he, that is this king, he will become very strong, but not by his own power. He will cause astounding devastation and will succeed in whatever he does. He will destroy the mighty men, the holy people, and he will cause deceit to prosper and will consider himself superior. The picture of evil. And it combines, when you put it all together, it combines arrogance, viciousness, and deceit. Or, to be more precise, the particular essence of the evil of this man was that it was against God, because he claimed to be God, and threw down the worship of the living God. It was against God. Secondly, it was against God's people. In verse 24, he persecuted the saints of God's people. And thirdly, it was against God's truth. Twice we're told that. The truth was thrown to the ground, and he reigned through deceit. In verse 12 and 25. And that was characteristic not only of him, Antiochus, but when you think about it, those are the characteristic marks of the enemies of God and of God's people all through history. It's an essence of evil which includes those three things especially: blasphemy, persecution, and lies. The familiar, repeated pattern was faced here by the people of Israel back in Old Testament days, as we're describing here, more than 150 years before Christ. It faces God's people in many places today. Let me read to you just a little bit of the detail of it so that you can hear what actually happened. Daniel only is a kind of foretelling of it, showing it in the broadest kind of symbolic pictures. But there's a book in the books of the Apocrypha, which are books that come from the period in between the Old and the New Testament. It's a series of books called the Books of Maccabees, which are historical books written about 100 years or so before Christ, which describe the struggle that the Israelites, the Jewish people, went through at this time. And I'll just read a few verses from 1 Maccabees chapter 1. After Alexander, the son of Philip, the Macedonian, came, he succeeded as king. He had previously become king of Greece. He fought many battles, conquered strongholds, and put to death the kings of the earth. He advanced to the very ends of the earth and plundered many nations. When the earth became quiet before him, he was exalted and his heart was lifted up. He gathered a very strong army and ruled over countries and nations and princes. After this, he, that is Alexander the Great, he fell sick, perceived that he was dying. So he summoned his most honored officers, who had been brought up with him from his youth. He divided his kingdom among them while he was still alive. And after Alexander had reigned for 12 years, he died. And then his officers began to rule, each in his own place, put on their crowns after his death, and caused many evils on the earth. From them came forth a sinful root, Antiochus Epiphanes, the son of King Antiochus. He had been a hostage in Rome, but he began to reign in the 137th year of the kingdom of Greece, which was about 175 BC. And so it goes on. After subduing Egypt, Antiochus returned in the 143rd year and went up against Israel, came to Jerusalem with a strong force, arrogantly entered into the sanctuary, that's the temple. He took the golden altar, the lampstand to the light, all the utensils, took away the table of the bread of the presence, the cups of the drink offerings, the bowls, the censers, the crowns, the decoration, the front of the temple. He stripped it all off, took the silver and gold and the costly vessels, and took all the hidden treasures that he found. And taking them all, he went to his own land. He shed much blood and spoke with great arrogance. Then the king, same man, wrote to the whole kingdom that all the people should give up their customs. And he sent letters to the messengers and through messengers to Jerusalem to forbid burnt offerings and sacrifices and drink offerings, to profane the Sabbaths, to defile the sanctuary and the priests, to build altars to other gods, to sacrifice pigs and other unclean animals, to leave their sons uncircumcised. They were to make themselves abominable so that they would forget the law and change all the ordinances. And he said, whoever doesn't obey this will die. The books of the law, that's the scriptures, their Bible at that time, all the books of the law that they found, they tore to pieces and burned with fire. And anyone found possessing the book of the covenant, their scriptures, or anyone who adhered to the law was condemned to death by the decree of the king. They kept using violence against Israel. Many in Israel stood firm and were resolved in their hearts not to eat the unclean food and chose to die rather than be defiled by the food or to betray the holy covenant. And they did die. And very great wrath came upon Israel. That's the description of the events in Israel under Antiochus Epiphanes. It describes one period of history. But there is a sense in which it is typical. It's describing a pattern of evil which has occurred many times in every era. Jewish people, of course, see Antiochus Epiphanes as the anticipation of many other horrors that they suffered during their history, from the destruction of the temple by Rome in 70 AD through to the horrid pogroms that happened against Jewish people in the so-called Christian states of Christendom, and ultimately, of course, in the Holocaust. So they see this as a prefiguration of those things. And Christians, of course, have suffered from tyrants all down through history who have tried to stamp out the Christian faith and destroy the church. Whether we think of Roman emperors like Nero, or the persecution and banning and burning of the Bible and so on that happened under atheistic communist states, or the sufferings even today of many Christian believers in countries like Nigeria, India, Sri Lanka, Malaysia, and many other places where Christians are suffering. And there are more subtle forms of hostility towards Christians in the church, even in Western countries, even here, with the same three seeds within it. Blasphemous hatred of God, attack upon Christian people, often when they're vulnerable, and deception and lies and myths of all kinds. So there's a pattern of empires, there's a portrait of evil, but where will it all end? And that's really another part of this message, which is a preview of the end. Look very carefully at verses 17 and 19, or 17 through 19. As he, that is the angel Gabriel, came near to the place where I was standing, I was terrified and fell prostrate. And he said to me, Son of man, understand that the vision concerns the time of the end. And then in verse 19 it says, this will happen in the time of wrath, because the vision concerns the appointed time of the end. Now the words and the phrases vary a bit, but it's clearly talking about something significant, a moment, an event, which can be called the end. And yet, clearly, what happened in 175 to 167 BC, before Christ, under Antiochus, the desecration of the temple, the persecution of the Jews and so on, was not literally the end of the world. I mean, we're still here, so it wasn't, couldn't it be? And yet it's still described as the end. It's rather like, you know, when you go and you watch a movie, eventually on the screen comes the end. But you know that doesn't mean the end of the world. It's the end of that particular event which has led to that climax at that point. So it's quite important, actually, that we try to get a careful grasp of how the Bible uses this expression, the end, or the times of the end. There's a whole industry these days called the end times. It's a great predictive industry which makes a lot of money and sells a lot of books and makes a lot of movies, all dedicated to telling us that we're living in the end times, so-called. Of course, in a sense, we've been living in the last days ever since Jesus rose from the dead, and especially since the day that we are celebrating today. Today is Pentecost Sunday, the day we remember the outpouring of God's Spirit on his people, which the prophet Joel had said would happen in the last days. And Peter stands up and says, brothers, it's here. The last days are here because the Messiah has come and died and risen again and the Holy Spirit has come. We are already living, as it were, in the last great era of history. But sometimes in the Bible gives us, as it were, signposts along the way to the ultimate final ending of history. You notice in verse 23, a little phrase, it says, in the latter part of their reign, when rebels or rebellion has become completely wicked, literally when rebellion has become full, something has happened, something has reached a climax of wickedness and evil. It's a phrase which echoes another time we read it in Genesis chapter 15, verse 16, where God had said to Abraham that there would come a day when his descendants would come back and take the land of Canaan. But God says, not yet. Because he says, the iniquity, the wickedness of the Canaanites is not yet full. But it will be someday. There will come a day when their wickedness will reach such a point that God will say, the end for this generation. And there is a sense in which the conquest under Joshua was the end of the story for that particular generation. The prophet Amos, when he was talking about the fact that God's people had been so sinful and wicked and rebellious against him, said this. This is Amos. Hey, the Lord showed me a basket of ripe fruit and said, what do you see? And I said, I see a basket of ripe fruit. And the Lord said to me, the end has come for my people Israel. The end is ripe, like a fruit comes to that end of its maturation, and I will spare them no longer. And so for that generation, the end was the exile. Similarly, there were other acts of God's judgment in history. 70 AD, when the temple was destroyed, that Jesus himself predicted was the end at that point. Paul points to an end in 1 Thessalonians 2. So, you see, all through the scriptures, there are these moments that the Bible describes as ends or endings. An era coming to an end of great and accumulated of generations of wickedness and resistance and rejection of God, which eventually comes to an end and God says, enough is enough, we're stopping here. And then sometimes God does something else and moves on. Eventually, it will be the final end when the Lord returns and we have a new heavens and a new earth and the end of the old creation. But until that point, there are these moments in history, this patterning of endings. We may well be facing another end time at this very time. The endings, perhaps, of Western superiority and dominance on the globe, such as we have known it for the past few centuries. Many of the signs are there. Similar kind of signs that you see in the blasphemous arrogance of Antiochus Epiphany, the blasphemous arrogance of the kingdom of mammon and money and consumerism. Who are the so-called masters of the universe, as they like to refer to themselves? Or the terrifying cost of military dominance and superiority, just as those other great empires rule the world by the sword or the spear, so our world is ruled by terrifying expenditure on military arms and bombs and weapons. Or the consequences of climate change, such as we are now seeing and wondering, where is that going to go? Life, in a sense, as we know it, has become unsustainable in many ways. And are we coming to a point where God is saying, enough is enough for the moment? And will that then mean the end of the world? Could do. I don't know. And I don't think anybody has the right or the authority to say, yes, for sure, it may do. Who knows? The Lord is still sovereign. There can come an ending which is not necessarily the end of the world, but is still an ending as far as history is going to this point. And God has got something else to lead us. People thought at many points in history over the last century that it was the end of the world. They were sure it was the end of the world when the Roman Empire collapsed. Martin Luther was certain that the world would end in his lifetime in the 1500s. People have thought of the ends of the world many times. We do not know. The call that is given to us is to be ready for whenever it happens. And while we're being ready, to be faithful, to endure, to wait. And that brings us, therefore, to our final point. Because we have to ask the question that is in the title of our sermon, how long? How long do we have to wait? How long will it be before the end of all these things? Before the Lord intervenes? Before God does something and takes action and puts down the arrogant and the blasphemous from their place of dominance and intervenes on behalf of the weak and the poor and the oppressed and reverses the way in which the world is run? We ask that question. And so the final note of this chapter, and surely the whole reason why it was written, is to bring a word of encouragement. We've seen the pattern of empires, the pattern of evil, the marks of the end or endings, but there's also this word of encouragement. Notice in verse 13 and 14, that question is asked, how long will it take for the vision to be fulfilled? And you notice in verse 25 and 26 that the encouragement comes that God will bring it to an end, will bring an end to the rule of this vaunting, self-arrogating ruler, Antiochus. He will come to an end, as all rulers and all empires eventually do. How long, it says. The answer is mysterious, isn't it? How long? And the answer is 2,300 evenings and mornings. And you say, what on earth does that mean? It could either mean, of course, in a literal sense, 2,300 actual days, which would mean about 6.5 years or so, or it could have meant the morning and evening sacrifice, which happened therefore twice a day, and so it's divided by two, you get about 1,150 days, which is about 3.5 years. And so people have said this is perhaps a pointer to the fact that the rule of Antiochus Epiphanes, in which the temple was actually desecrated and being used as a place of the worship of one of the gods of Greece, did in fact last approximately that length of time, half a dozen years or so, before it was recaptured and cleansed. But I think the point is more important than just trying to calculate precise calendars. What it is saying is that it is a limited time. It's not going to be forever. His time will come. He will be destroyed, but not by human hand, it says, but by God himself, because God is the one who remains in control. And so as in all the rest of Israel's Old Testament history, you see, as indeed the history of the people of God all the way through, from the Bible times right through to the present, those who set out to destroy the people of God ultimately find themselves destroyed by him. God remains on the throne. That's the word of encouragement. But I want to make it even stronger and take us, as we draw towards a conclusion, back to the beginning. Where do we start? We started with the imagery of animals, didn't we? Rams and he-goats. And we saw that what they represent is human kings and conquerors and emperors, governments and presidents and people who have power, trampling and butting their way through history. The Bible ends with animal imagery again being used, but in a very different way. The book of Revelation, of course, in many respects is rather like the book of Daniel. John, the author of the book of Revelation, has these incredible visions, many of them very fantastic, with beasts of all sorts in there, even four horses riding through history, bringing conquest and war and famine and death. But who is in control of all of that? Who sits on the throne of God? Who is worthy of all honor, praise, and worship and power because he actually is the sovereign of the universe, master of the universe, ruler of the kings of the earth, as he's described in Revelation 1? And to give us some sense of that, John uses two pictures, doesn't he? One of the elders came to me and said to me, this is Revelation 5, verse 5, do not weep, see the lion of the tribe of Judah, the root of David, has triumphed. And he is worthy to open the scroll of history and govern in the place of God. So John is, as it were, told about a lion king. But he says, when I looked, what I saw was a lamb. A lamb looking as if it had been slain, standing in the center of the throne. Obviously meaning and implying and clearly picturing the crucified Jesus. And so John tells us that we're not involved, you see, in a history of goats and rams and all the other things that symbolize human empires and evils and endings. He says the encouragement is that on the throne of the universe is the crucified Christ. The government rests with him. That is the assurance that comes. The one who died and rose again is on the throne and reigns. And therefore they sing out, don't they? You are worthy. Worthy is the Lamb to receive praise and honor and glory and power. Because you were slain and with your blood you purchased people for God from every tribe and language and people and nation and made them to be kingdom and priests to serve our God, and they will reign on the earth. The God of Daniel, the God of John is still on the throne, and he will ultimately defeat and destroy all the evil doers of the world who rule the world without repentance. In unrepented wickedness, will face ultimately the destruction of God. That leaves just one final thought, and it's the very last verse of the chapter, and in some ways, I have to say, it's almost my favorite verse. Because what we read at the end of the chapter is that Daniel said, well, whew, I was exhausted and ill for days. Well, you would be, wouldn't you, with this sort of vision? And then look what he says in the middle of verse 27. Then I got up, and I went about the king's business. He went back to the office. He went back to his desk. He got on with his job. And what was his job? Daniel was a civil servant. He was simply an administrator in the government of the Babylonian Empire. And so having had this incredible vision, Daniel got on with his life. Went back to the place where God had put him. Carried on with the work and responsibilities that were his. He's had this appalling, scary, prophetic vision. But he didn't then go around, as it were, like some wild prophet of doom, throw down his job, set up some commune of end times wonks. He didn't go into all that kind of stuff. He just got on with life. He adjusted his worldview. He'd never be the same. He's now going to be at his work, in his place of responsibility, knowing the sovereignty of God. Accepting the transience of all human empires, including the one he was working for, anticipating the terrible evils of a world in opposition to God, and therefore not being shocked by them or surprised by them, but knowing they would come and why they would come and what form they would take. And he knew that the end would someday come in God's own time. But he went back to work. And so do we. Tomorrow, one way or another. And we need to take with us, you see, back from this chapter, not some sort of scary, oh, I wonder when all this is going to happen, but simply, this is in God's hands. This is the encouragement, this is the assurance of God, that whatever is happening in our world today, and whatever will happen in our world today, we go back to the place that God has assigned us, and we get on with the job that God has given us to do. We witness to this living, sovereign God of history. And some of you will go back to places of work tomorrow where you are suffering for the sake of Jesus. Persecution or ridicule or various forms of the tough reality of what it means to be a Christian in the workplace in this country. And some of you, I know, belong to countries and have families in lands in this world where you probably have family members who are being persecuted, possibly killed, struggling for their faith. In countries represented in this church. For you also, this is a word of encouragement. It will not go on forever. The Lord is in control, and those who entrust themselves to him are ultimately safe and secure in the hands of the God of Daniel, the God who gives this promise. It will come to an end. So let's be assured by that, and let's go to our work tomorrow with that sense, the presence of the living God, and the sovereignty of the Lamb of God who was slain over all human history.